At 0800 hours, prisoner Murphy,
through carelessness on his part, was found dead in vent shaft 17. He seems to have been sucked into a ventilator. Prisoner's bogs and rings are missing. There seems to be a good chance that they have met with foul play at the hands of prisoner Golic. We need to organize and send out a search party. I can only hope we are able to all pull together over the next few days until the rescue team arrives for Lieutenant Ripley.
It's here. We got Clemens.
Stop this raving at once.
I'm telling you. It's here.
Welcome to the Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast, Alien Retrospective Series.
Is this going to be a stand-up fight, sir, or another bug hunt?
Join Garrett.
Check it out. I am the ultimate badass.
Yes, sir.
State of the badass art. You do not want to fuck with me.
Matt.
I work for the company, but don't let that fool you. I'm really an okay guy.
And Adam.
You've been in my life so long. I can't remember anything else.
As they go to another system and investigate the popular horror science fiction series where no one can hear you scream.
This is so nuts. I mean, listen to what you're saying. It's paranoid delusion. It's really sad.
From the 1979 original.
Take a look at this, man.
All the way through Alien Romulus, this newest installment coming out this year.
Did IQs just drop sharply while I was away?
The boys will examine each film individually and find out what the company's real intentions are.
Looks like love at first sight to me.
So strap yourselves in, podcast listeners.
Stand by.
The Percolated Media Alien Retrospective begins now.
Let's go!
Aliens, released July 18th, 1986. Budget was $18.5 million. Box office, $183.3 million. And this is directed by King of the World himself, Mr. James Cameron. First time returning to James Cameron's filmography since we did Avatar about a year and a half ago at this point, 2 years. Here we are. Aliens. This was one, as I mentioned in last week's show, this is the one I saw first. It was on TV, I believe, and me and my friend, we watched it. I was hooked. I enjoyed it quite immensely. This is before I even knew there was an alien. So this one is my virgin entry in Aliens as a child. Adam, when did you see this big film?
This one is one that I'm sure was on TV at home. Was not a theater watch, even though my loving father took me to see things like 2010 and Return of the Jedi in theaters. I think this one, I remember it playing at home. I remember it being on at home. I'm sure I would have seen it before Alien, just because this came out kind of as VHS tapes were really booming, you know, when those got released. And we had a black box, so things like HBO, Cinemax, Skinemax were always on. But this was one of those rotations. It formulated my childhood. Like, I grew up with Xenomorphs and Predators and Xenomorphs more so than anything else. I think I've talked before, like, we had the H.R. Giger book in my house. So these visuals have been part of my life since I was a kid.
All right, and Matt, I imagine you saw this, what, after you watched Alien, or did you watch this first? What's your history with Alien?
I saw these in order of release, so this was not one of the properties I jumped around on. I think before I had seen this, though, I had played at least one of the 8,000 video games that are related to this IP, specifically this movie. It was like an arcade rail shooter. I was probably like six or seven.
Oh, fun, yes.
If that, and I was like, oh, this is cool, and I knew what Alien was because of the great movie ride at Disney. That was my only connection until I actually watched these when I was a little bit older. But I thought it was cool when I was like, oh, the guy who made, at the time, two Terminator movies, the only two in existence, made an Alien sequel. That definitely got me excited.
Yeah, and you know what? This was a movie that a couple years ago for Christmas, I got the behind-the-scenes book, pretty much detailed the making of this movie, and it is just as hellish as you could imagine, because after Alien had come out, and it was the talk, as I mentioned, It was the only space movie that was on the desks of executives at 20th Century Fox. And when they were looking for something to do after Star Wars, that was the one they greenlit. And it was released. And lo and behold, they hit pay dirt, becomes a hit. And Walter Hill and David Geller, they were already thinking about a sequel. And as they were thinking about it, somebody who had worked on a bunch of Roger Corman films, and he was working on sets and things, and he had just written the script called Terminator. He's walking around, and these guys had seen the Terminator script, and they wanted Cameron to do this movie. So they get Cameron in, and Cameron agrees to it, and it gets delayed. So Cameron works on Rambo First Blood Part 2. He does the script for that. Maybe we'll cover that one day. And he shoots Terminator, because in the interim, they didn't have Schwarzenegger set to shoot. They had to wait for him to finish Conan the Destroyer, because it was Dino De Laurentiis, who we'll be talking about again soon. Dino De Laurentiis had Arnold on the contract to do a second Conan film, so he had to do that. And then in the interim of that, Cameron works on Rambo. And then, eventually, he shoots the Terminator. And you know what? It's really weird, boys, because when Giller and Hill were talking to Cameron about doing this, Cameron said, look, I want to shoot this Terminator movie, and they could have just as easily, and it's happened a lot, it's scheduled conflicts, so we're not going to let you shoot this. They waited. Executives never wait for a director. But they waited for him to finish Terminator, and he did, and within a few days after Terminator, he was right on this set. So, Adam, I mean, that's pretty rare, isn't it? That means they have confidence in this director.
That's crazy, especially for somebody so new, so I don't want to say untested, because, you know, there was some things, but it's almost in the video, music video type realm, where it's just like, this guy isn't proven himself directly, but they were willing to wait for him. So, I mean, he was big dick swinging way, way back then, and that ego of his was massive back then. It's only grown since. But it's crazy, because that doesn't happen today, more or less, back then, unless you really, really earned it. And he hadn't at that point. So he either knew where some bodies were buried, he really had it in with somebody, or somebody really believed in him, and it's historical what came out of it, but it is astounding that it went the way it did.
Matt, are you surprised they waited?
No, because there's something I want to talk about, production history. If you remember, Giler and Hill also sued 20th Century Fox in between Alien and Aliens because of there was like unpaid, not residuals, but there were like expenses that they were waiting for. And Cameron got on their radar, no pun intended, because of the script for Terminator, which is a great script, of course, but Cameron, the idea of him directing it was not entirely on the table. So I think they were kind of smart to hedge their bets to avoid taking a guy who couldn't handle this. They waited for Terminator actually to get made to see what he did as a director, because before that he had done Piranha 2, The Spawning. Which
he didn't even complete it.
But he's right. It's the best flying fish movie ever made to his to his very sharp, he's got sharp wit, despite his massive ego. And I like that they had the guys to wait to see if he could handle a movie like this. And obviously Terminator was a cultural touchstone even back then. So all the stars aligned, as did, you know, the producer Galen Hurd. I'm sure him being in a relationship with her helped as a bit of an endorsement. I don't know if this story's true, but with all things James Cameron, I tend to believe them as fact. Went into the studio and wrote Aliens on a whiteboard and put a dollar sign through the S.
Yes, that's in the book as well. They talk about that. Yeah, and Galen Hurd, him and her had not started a relationship until right towards the end of this shoot. So he insisted her be on this production, and people already were scoffing at him because female producers were not a thing back then. And so she hadn't proven herself either, but they went along with that as well. And, of course, another big thing was Giler and Hill weren't big on bringing Sigourney Weaver back. They were okay with doing a movie without her being in it. And that was a demand that Cameron made, was, look, if I'm going to do this movie, we need to have Weaver on this film, because the idea I have revolves all around her.
Yeah, he wrote the treatment, his treatment as a direct sequel involving her. He's like, look, if you're going to hire me to make a sequel, I got to make it a continuation in some degree beyond just using the aliens. The Xenomorph name actually comes from his short story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he was told before he went to Terminator, we got her. He comes back from Terminator and he gets told, nope, we don't have her. She was going to France to shoot another film. And this really pissed Cameron off. And he's like, okay, well, I'll wait for her too. But there was no guarantee she was even going to do it because, look, you have this Canadian director, as Adams mentioned, not really proven, at least until Terminator was coming out. He met with her and spoke to her about his ideas. It was a big negotiation. She did not say yes right away, but she was impressed by Cameron's ideas. And she said, okay, I'll do it on three conditions. And those three conditions were, I'm not going to handle a gun. Well, I want to die and I want to have sex with an alien. Those were her three conditions. And we'll talk about it as we talk about the next couple films, but all of those get fulfilled throughout the course of this series.
Yeah, stay tuned to the next couple weeks.
Exactly.
Yeah, and this is really the press, when you think about this movie's a trendsetter in a lot of ways. The idea of bringing back a previously established female character was almost unheard of. You know, with these sequels around this time, you know, of course you'd bring Rambo back and Rocky and characters of that ilk, but, you know, look at the other comparable franchise around this time. Halloween had done it. Nightmare on Elm Street was about to do it, but Friday the 13th was a revolving door, and so the idea of doing this was smart. I think this movie would be very different and obviously not have the emotional resonance it does without bringing her back.
I was going to say exactly, Matt just hit one of my things that I was thinking of too, is back then, if an actress didn't just capitulate to all the demands, it was like, okay, never mind, we'll recast. We'll move on past you. You can't say that women are treated wonderfully now in Hollywood. 40 years ago, whew, even worse. So it went as well as it did, and I'm using that in quotes, is again just another piece of the film where it's like, man, sometimes things align for a good reason, and much like some other big name heroines that we've talked about that kind of catapulted certain genres and certain efforts, this is one of them, not just what she did last film, but the way that Sigourney came back for this one, beyond the payday. I think it really is a watershed moment for a lot of women in cinema.
Well, let's talk about that payday, because that was another big condition, is A, she liked a certain scene in this movie, which we'll talk about, did not make the final cut, and her manager demanded $1 million paycheck, which in 1986, most males didn't get that, let alone females. And you know what? She got paid, good for her, ended up getting an Oscar nomination for this, which is another thing that is completely unheard of and was completely groundbreaking at the time. So, as Adam said, good for her for standing up to what she believed in, and good for her for getting what she demanded, and good for her for enhancing the movie as she did, because that gave it a little bit of credibility. So we open up with a truly haunting theme from James Horner, as the blue tint that Cameron is so known for forms the word aliens and the cast is displayed. Right away, guys, this proves to be pretty damn efficient.
We talked just a week ago about that long, slow opening to the title, and James Cameron's going to show, I mean, he may not be Lucas, but he definitely goes with some faster, more intense parts of what came before, and that it's kind of obvious right off the bat.
Well, it's one of a few notable instances in this movie where it's really James Cameron riffing on the original movie just with his own flourishes. I mean, look, this movie, in a lot of ways, for being a sequel, you could also argue in a lot of ways it's also kind of a remake of the first Alien, just with a lot of changes. It's funny, his ex-wife made a movie called Blue Steel, because that's what I would describe his color palette to be.
Yes. And you know what? And while this is known as an action film, I'm going to point out some truly horrific moments that put this in the realm of horror. And I think this opening theme is very much that. It just kind of rises and rises and rises. It builds and builds and builds, and then you just get this horrible screaming at the end. Like, it's truly a really good theme. And
well, it's a blend. It's yes. Like how the first Alien, you could argue, it's a horror film, arguably, first and foremost, but you could also look at it as legitimate science fiction. This one, you could look at structurally and scale-wise, it's very much an action movie, even in line with a lot of stuff that was coming around that time. But it's also deeply rooted in horror. I mean, this is very comparable to the first Terminator film in a lot of ways. Back when dinosaurs roamed the Earth, Garrett and I reviewed the Terminator franchise. You'll never see those or hear those shows again. But this definitely feels like the middle movie between the first Terminator and what he would do with the second one, where that one is a full-blown action movie with little to no horror tinges. This feels like the progression between going from the first Terminator, which I do think is, that's as much of a slasher film as the first Alien is. And this really strikes a fine balance. So yeah, it's great how it balances a lot of different styles and tones.
We cut to space as the credits continue, and right now is when I'm going to mention the music, which, as I already mentioned, is done by James Horner. Now, this film pretty much ruined the relationship between Cameron and Horner for years, as Horner thought Cameron put too much pressure on him to do this score. The film fell well behind schedule, and the way it was laid out was Horner was given 2 weeks to do the entire thing. Yes, 2 weeks. This caused major friction, and this isn't the last time this aspect of production will be mentioned, and the two had a major falling out until Cameron pretty much called Horner up and apologized, and he brought him on for Titanic and the rest of his Oscar history. As far as this score goes, I love it. I remember movie trailers taking cues from it until the mid to late 90s, and it's just magnificent as we have this opening theme, which is so haunting, but he also has a pulse-pounding second part that really gets the adrenaline going later on in the film. I know Titanic won him the Oscars, and he had some great highlights in his career, but I find this particular score to be a top highlight for Horner. I think it's fantastic.
No, sir, I don't like it.
Really?
I think it gets chopped to hell, and I think Cameron butchered what was a beautiful score. Now, I'm going to say my notes are done on the director's cut. I watched them both, but I took notes on the director's cut. I think when that's put back in, I think it's a better score. But I think the theatrical release of this, I think Horner had every reason to be pissed and to stop working with Cameron, because I think he just butchers it, speeds it up, slows it down, and I think he reworks music to fit what he was doing, not the other way around, which is an insult to the composer. I think the sound work in the last 20% of this movie is phenomenal, and I think the Foley work is done. But no, if I was Horner, I would have punched Cameron in his face for what he did to my score.
Oh my God, when you hear the ding, 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 like all of that is, oh my God.
I think the opening is great. I think the opening is great because you have an opening to a film. I think throughout the movie, it gets chopped to hell.
Well, I'm talking about when she's getting Newt out in the hangar. Like, I think all that stuff is really good.
I think the sound design is good. I think the score is, yeah. Hot take.
All right. Matt, I know you're not big on music, but you got to be the tiebreaker here, sir.
Hey, you stole my bit. I'm the wrong person to be a tiebreaker. I love the theme, but I'm not as in line with Adam, but I can clearly see in the editing process where the score is fragmented and chopped up to fit the pacing of the movie. I do think it's a bit of a disservice, but I'm not going to go as far as to call this a bad score at all because, you know, memorability, it's definitely high up there for me.
Wow, our first big surprise of this podcast. Interesting. We focus on the escape pod that we saw Ripley leave in last week's film. As we see Weaver in a deep cryogenic sleep, the door opens as a ship shines some rays inside. They come across the pod, and I love this dissolve Cameron does from the pod with Ripley inside to planet Earth. I thought that was amazing. We cut to a space station as Ripley wakes up, and here comes good old Burke with that freaking cat Jones. Now, Burke is played by Paul Reiser, which is an interesting bit of casting because despite other semi-dramatic roles like the one he had in Diner, Reiser was known as a comedian around this time. But let me tell you, there were a ton of roles like this in the 80s of someone with their own agenda pretending to be a nice guy, but no one plays Slimy better than Reiser here. I think he's great in this movie.
This is the unsung hero of this movie in a lot of ways, not as far as story context, obviously, but as we talked about with Terminator, James Cameron doesn't get enough credit for casting against type. Schwarzenegger was a big one, if you know the history of the Terminator. This one, he sort of has that Jeff Bridges, I'm your buddy type of quality, which is why his role in the first Iron Man works so well. Here it's that, you know, because before this he was in Beverly Hills Cop as well. So you felt like it's like, oh, I know this guy. So the idea of the corporate yuppie who's not even the CEO of Weyland-Yutani. He's like the marketing rep. But so the idea of that character in the 80s, because remember, Wall Street's not too far away. And stuff like RoboCop that really took corporations to task, especially in film and science fiction, are on the precipice. So this conceit is nothing new, and it's played out really well throughout the movie, but I think Reiser gives a great sleazeball type of performance that sadly James Cameron could not replicate with Giovanni Ribisi in Avatar, as we joked about on that show. It's borderline the same character, but you need an actor who can actually pull this off, and I think Reiser does that really well. Especially with that well-coiffed borderline perm he has through most of this movie.
Yes.
That doesn't seem to get fritzed up at all.
Oh, I'm mad about this performance. It's that good.
Oh, shit. Nice.
Sorry, I love Mad About You. I didn't think I'd slip it in that early. You know what? As somebody who spent a lot of time as a middle manager, I got to say, I love Burke. I think it's an amazing casting job, and I think he does really well with it. Like, you feel he's slimy, but watching him play just all over the way he does. I just think he brings a credibility to that role that so much other Ribisi does. It just makes it cartoonish, where Paul Reiser's, there's something natural about the way that he plays it. And I'll lay it out here. If nobody has read the current Aliens What If comics, Paul Reiser and his brother wrote an alternate ending for Burke, and it's at least worth picking up and checking out.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that. So right away, Burke says that he works for the company, but don't let that fool you. He's a pretty okay guy. He then tells Ripley that she's been out in space for 57 years as she drifted through the system, and a salvage team was fortunate enough to find her.
To me, this, and this was one of my first big notes, this is, I think, an incredible conceit, because you're making a sequel, but this is a way to change what you are going to be slavishly required to stick to. By being able to set it so far in the future of a sequel, you get to kind of pick and choose what you want to connect. And I think that is a ridiculously smart writing choice.
And it's also very well done from a writing perspective in character escalation with sequels. You always want to raise the stakes. And not only do you have the PTSD component, which we'll get into shortly, but also the idea of time displacement. You survive this traumatic event, and you come back to a world that you don't even recognize, and really you have no place in outside of company testimony and just being used as a tool to save the reputation of the company. And it's the whole no one believes you type of thing, which is always scary depending on this circumstance. So again, I think everything that we say sequels should do as far as setup and conception, it's nailing everything. And I think that's why this felt so groundbreaking at the time, was it was not just, I feel like this was the last sequel to do something before we got to the movie that I think really turned sequels into just doing the same movie again for pop culture, being, I guess I could spoil it, I feel like Die Hard 2 was the pivot point, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. We then cut to a scene that, okay, and reading a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff for this movie, I know that Cameron included this nightmare scene because he knew the audience was clamoring for the alien to show up, and he also knew that they weren't going to get to the aliens for quite a while. So he included this little fake-out as a way to whet the audience's appetite for what's to come, but I think it's a slight misstep. I don't like the camera showing the hissing of Jones as a way to preview that Ripley is not in a normal state, and I think the effect of the alien almost emerging from her stomach looks bad. Though I will say, it does serve another purpose, which we'll talk about as we get deeper into the film, but how do we feel about this little nightmare scene?
This feels mandated. This feels like, hey, if you're not going to get us some of that horror for 45, 50 minutes, you better do something right up front. And to me, this also shows, though, where the last film, Alien, was a drama thriller, this is a horror action, because it's going to give you this right up front, and then it's going to remove it for a long time. But without this here, it would have been closer to last week's film. It feels like a mandate. I think it's a little bit of a misstep. I think this kind of sets the stage, though, for what the movie is, hey, we're going to give you this instead of what you had before. We're going to give you that instead of what you had before.
It at the very least ties in thematically, so I can't call it superfluous, but it reminds me so much of, and it's just so funny, this came out the same year, they do something very similar in The Fly, Cronenberg's Fly remake, with the baby.
Yeah.
That's also a nightmare hallucination. It's just funny they came out the same year, but it doesn't really bother.
Now, immediately after this scene, in the director's cut, there is a scene of Burke showing Ripley pictures of her daughter, who's actually Weaver's mom, those pictures, and him giving her the news that her daughter is now dead. Of course, Scott hadn't directed Ripley in the previous film, thinking that she was a mother, but this is a crucial scene that I'm sad is cut. Reason being, how the movie ends is a nice little bookend to this scene, and I'll get to that when we discuss the ending. And this is also the scene that Weaver read the script and loved, and was a big reason why she took the film. Anybody else see this scene and agree with me? Adam, you did watch the director's cut. What'd you think of this?
I watched this scene. I like the scene a lot. I think it really brings something to Ripley and Sigourney Weaver's characterization. I don't want to say without this, it doesn't fully justify Newt, because I think you intrinsically get that mother thing there. But I think this adds to it. I think this gives some more pathos to it. I don't think it belongs in the cut that was released theatrically, but I think it belongs in a better cut than the director's cut also. I think it's a really good scene. I think Sigourney Weaver really brings everything when it comes to the daughter reveal, that those entire couple minutes. I think it's a great scene. It's sad to be missed, but I don't think it belongs in the theatrical cut either.
I'm disappointed that it was not in the conventional cut that the most people have seen, because you could argue it's certainly the most blatant tie-in to the maternal aspect with Newt, but I'm happy it's here. I'm happy it was shot fully. This doesn't feel like a deleted scene where, like, you can see the boom mic in the frame. there's stuff like that you can find on a lot of special features. But I would also say, I think another thing that this does really well that a lot of sequels should learn from is incorporating logical information and character progression without feeling like you're retconning. Because in the first movie, it's never brought up that she's a mom. But you also learn nothing about the families of anyone on the Nostromo. Because it's not part of their work. They don't really like each other, so why would they get overly personal? But then when you think about it, you're like, oh yeah, it makes sense for her to have a kid. So it's well done as far as how it's building on someone we thought we knew, and it's just adding another piece to the puzzle.
So they're going over her crew who died on the Nostromo last week, and they're having her tell the story of what happened, which led to her detonating the destruction of the ship. And I do like this line that Weaver says, where she's just like, did IQ dramatically drop while I was away?
Oh, she should jump forward another 57 years.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yep.
We were so good here. She earned a Best Actress nod at the time when the Academy was way just anti-science fiction, and I think she earns it in this film. Adam, you've talked about how much you liked her in this. Matt, how do you feel about Weaver in this?
It's still shocking in hindsight that the Academy, even back then, the last decade plus has been Oscars so white and Oscars are closed-minded. But if you go back in history, you can find outliers like this where they actually gave nominations that don't feel token. Like, this didn't feel like they were throwing a bone. I think it was actually earned. But it also helps that Alien had won for Best Visual Effects and was, you know, kind of a classy type of production. So I think that definitely is advantageous. But you could also argue they nominated her because there was no way she was going to win if you look at who won that year.
It's crazy, though. If this gets released today, there's not a chance she gets a nomination out of this. You look at somebody like Angela Bassett, and that was political for the reason of that nomination and the reason for that loss. The Academy has completely reverted back to being anti-genre of almost everything.
Well, let's also remember, if Charlize Theron couldn't make it for Fury Road, which is a comparable type of performance, I don't think Sigourney would have a shot nowadays.
Especially if she was already an Academy Award-winning actress at that point, yeah.
Molly Matlin ended up winning that year, which, I mean, I guess you do give it to the deaf girl, but...
Oh, well, yeah, so convincing playing a deaf woman.
Yeah.
Congratulations, Marley!
We see Ripley ask the company to check out LV-426, but she's told that people have been over there over the last 20 years, and they haven't heard of any other organism out there, despite there being 60 or 70 families. Ripley shuts the door on Burke, but he tells her that they've lost contact with LV-426, and they need her to go out there to help retrieve the signal and find out what's going on. Now, I do admire Cameron for doing everything he can to explain reasons for Ripley going back out there, but really, the fact that she goes back... Matt, do you like how Cameron is justifying her eventually going back out here?
I think he's doing as good of a job as he can, because with the way the debriefing of what happened occurs, the company technically would have enough evidence to throw her in prison for destroying company property and outright murder because she can't prove there was an alien. So Burke could easily strong-arm her into forcing her to go. But it's also, this movie is also about PTSD and confronting trauma head-on in a very conservative Reagan type of way through force, very much of its time in that regard. So this doesn't have the problem of Jurassic Park 3, or the second one, where it's like, why would Malcolm or Grant go back to that island? Which, by the way, the fact that they colonized this, that's the equivalent of the mayor opening the beaches again in Jaws.
And you know what? In that director's cut, you do see a scene of them being here, and Newt and her brother, played by her real-life brother, by the way, messing around with their family and things and playing out there. And you know what? I'm glad that was cut. And unlike the last scene, I'm glad we didn't see that, because I like the fact that we see Newt for the first time along with Ripley.
Or no, you're talking about the Hadley's Hope scene. I think what's cool in that is you actually see the derelict ship again.
That's true.
I mean, they could have been cut a little different. You maybe don't need the entire thing, but see, and I think it's the longest cut scene between the directors and the theatrical, but you actually get to at least see some of the people that were working here. You get to see them go out and explore this area, and you get to see that the corporation is also like, hey, this is going on. It's dangerous. Fuck you. Go do it anyway. So you get a little more of that there. If anybody hasn't watched the director's version of it, it is worth seeing on its own. Just expect that you're going to get not just extended takes, but some pretty big scene differences.
Definitely. And Adam, do you feel that Cameron justifies Ripley going back out there?
Kind of. I think you could have still done it differently, but to Matt's point, you know, you did it as good as you could have, all intents and purposes. To me, maybe you capture the ship and there's the reveal that where they take her for debriefing is LV-426. That she's on this planet, and it's like, oh, wait a minute, you took me back where? What the? And then go from there. But you gotta get your space marines, you gotta get your stuff in it, but it's as good as you could have gone. And, you know, Matt brought up, this is about facing your trauma, facing your fears, and conquering it.
Ripley's told that she's going to be surrounded by the best soldiers in the world, but she wants to stay and do her job, which is working forklifts. And I love Burke's response to this as he tells her, it's an honest living, but you're needed elsewhere.
That's a Vietnam type of...
Yes.
...of thing. He might as well be a military recruiter.
Mm-hmm.
This movie is also knees deep in Vietnam allegories.
Oh, God, yes. We cut to Ripley still waking up in cold sweats, and this is when she calls Burke back to tell him yes, she will go back out on the condition that they're going out there to destroy them. And Burke says, yep, you have my word. Right.
This is why you sign on the dotted line.
Yeah, exactly. But hey, at least the cat's staying behind this time.
Funny, because you look at her interactions with Burke, and you figure it's not too different than her interactions with Cameron. I'm not going to hold a gun, right? I'm going to have a daughter, right? I'm going to have sex with the alien, right? Yeah. I mean, Burke is Cameron at the end of the day.
So we cut to the pod's opening in a hall that is much brighter this time than last week. And here is when we get introduced to some characters. Ripley is who we see first, and she is joined by Drake, played by Mark Walston. And what are the first words out of his mouth? They ain't paying us enough for this. Sounds pretty much like Brett and Parker last week, which was a nice little callback.
Sounds like Murtaugh.
He's then joined by brown face actress Jeanette Goldstein, who's here as Vasquez. What a story this is. So the casting director saw Goldstein in a play in London. They really liked her, so they brought her to Cameron's attention. And his solution to the character that he had in mind was to put her in brownface to play a Latina soldier. She's a complete white girl. She plays in Terminator 2. She's a stepmom. She's also in Titanic. I find it funny that that's where they went with this character.
Not just the brown face, but to have a cholo bandana wrapped around her head the whole time.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Jesus.
You cannot get away with this today. We then meet Hicks, played by Michael Biehn, though it was almost played by Warriors actor James Remar. Cameron ended up doing to him what Peter Jackson did to Stuart Townsend in Lord of the Rings. He started seeing dailies. He didn't really like what he was seeing. Plus, Remar, if you read interviews with him around this time, he was heavy into drugs and he would come late to sets and he wasn't really prepared for this role. So Cameron called up his buddy from The Terminator, Michael Biehn. Guys, I mean, James Remar, he was in 48 Hours. He was a big part of the late 70s, early 80s. Hell, he's still working today. Do we think he could have played the Hicks character here?
I think he would have done fine. I think he would have given us a Hicks character that's different than just watching basically the same character from Terminator move over to the next set, which is kind of how I feel with Michael Biehn. But I like Michael Biehn here as well. But yeah, I think we would have been fine either way. As much as I like Biehn, he doesn't ring to me anything special, but he doesn't detract either. And I think that's important because this is Sigourney's movie.
Yeah, Biehn is a great everyman type of actor, but he never had... or has the charisma to really be front and center. He's the backseat driver through a lot of Terminator. Like, he's the exposition machine before he is the actual Linda Hamilton and Schwarzenegger 1A and 1B in that movie. Remar would have been good. I'm sure his eye motions would have been a lot more frantic based on the cocaine use, which is funny because Michael Biehn, I don't know if you've seen him lately, he looks like Emperor Palpatine nowadays.
He recently was on, maybe a few months now. The people that know me know I love the Inside EU podcast with Michael Rosenbaum, and he had Michael Biehn on it, and it is a fascinating listen.
Rosenbaum gets a lot of good people on that podcast.
And he's still getting residuals from this role, because if you listen to the game Alien Colonial Marines, he showed up, but he did not give two shits.
Yeah, we'll talk about him next week, too. And apparently he got a bigger check next week than he did in this film, but we'll get there.
But it's funny that Michael Biehn's not the only Terminator alumni that Cameron called for roles in this movie.
Yep, I was just getting to him. So then we have Hudson, played by the late, great Bill Paxton. Now, this guy probably has every line in the intro and outro to this podcast. And we'll get to know him more as we go on. But yeah, he is the line machine, right? He is the Lambert in this film, except in a way more entertaining way. Of course, everybody loves Hudson.
Absolutely love Bill Paxton. He pushes it right to that line, though. If you're starting to wear a little bit on this film, he will test that in some scene. But absolutely love Bill Paxton. In everything, whether it's Terminator, whether it's this, whether it's Twisters, whether it's Edge of Tomorrow, it's hard to not like the guy when he's on screen. He's just always brings a performance that he's going to stand out. Regardless of where you cast him, he is going to make sure you have to train the camera on him and put him in your cut.
You don't always like him if you've ever seen Frailty. It's funny, like, you know, in the 80s, he played a lot of different type of roles, because he's in Terminator as the cyberpunk gangster. He's in Weird Science as the older the brother. He did Near Dark right after this.
Yep.
He did Pass the Ammo, which is, that movie's insane.
Yeah.
Predator 2?
Yeah, Next of Kin.
Mm. Oh, God, I forgot he was in Next of Kin.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah, we'll talk about it again when we redo the Predator series, but yeah. I've always loved Bill Paxton in basically everything, but you're right. He's the quip machine that if this movie was made in the 2010s, he would have been played by Ryan Reynolds.
Oh.
Not saying I would have endorsed that. I'm just saying that that's kind of the comp.
Now, Cameron looks back on the way he portrayed Marines in this film, and he kind of cringes. His brother was a Marine, and he was trying to hit every emotion in Marines who fought in Vietnam dealt with. But by littering the film with straight archetypes, he didn't feel like he did a good job. Adam, as somebody who did serve, how do you feel about Cameron's portrayal of Marines in this?
I don't think he betrays anything militarily, in any sort of military at all. What I do think he does, and I think it's established here, I think it's a good job of giving us different characters to identify, because you could have just a mashup of people where you don't know who is who. You know who every character is because they're slightly distinguished, they look a little bit different, they're a different gender, they're a different skin tone. So that is efficient storytelling. In the way of trying to make him military-wise, he completely drops the ball, and he also completely and utterly ripped off the novel Starship Troopers for the way that he's trying to build a colonial Marines. I'm surprised this film is not sued up the ass and is not owned by the author of Starship Troopers for the way that Cameron rips off that book.
This is the movie I would use if I was teaching action film screenwriting, where so many action movies nowadays, I'm going to use like Suicide Squad as an example, where the characters are defined by their superpowers, by what they can do, or how they look. Aliens, to a certain degree, has that, but they're defined by their personality. And you would argue they're one note, but I think you could come up with a couple adjectives to describe each one. And because of that, you actually care about them when stuff happens to them, even if you don't necessarily like or identify with them. Even the minor ones, like Sergeant Apone, you know, the first thing he does is whip out a cigar as soon as he gets out of the hypersleep pod. Which, by the way, this scene is very similar to the opening of Alien with it's that.
Yep.
Yep.
He'll hold on shots of those pods, gives you the layout of the Sulaco, but I think the characterization, this is how you do it without a 20-minute info dump of saying, so what's your story, as they're sitting around the mess hall.
Which Bay did a lot of in Transformers. We got a lot of that.
Oh, yeah. This is like, you know, a lot of Michael Bay's stuff, like Six Underground has that problem. Even the Oceans movies, to Adam's point, I've never served in the military, but inaccuracies like that, I can't really criticize in a full science fiction context, because that's like me saying that the Rebel Alliance were bad soldiers, or the Stormtroopers. For a movie that's got a lot of action, it's imminently quotable, which is also the sign of a great action movie. But look at the poster. This Time It's War.
Uh-huh.
Alien, you had in space, no one can hear you scream. So they're two for two on iconic taglines.
And as much as you mentioned, you know, Paxton is obviously the quotable character. Everybody is given something. Everybody is given one or two lines that you would quote and identify with that individual.
Vasquez, you ever been mistaken for a man? No, have you?
No, have you?
God damn it, that was my next note. Fuck you guys. I love the characters of Vasquez and Drake. They kind of have this antagonist relationship between the two of them, but it really resolves itself really well by the end. We're also hearing the soldiers gossip about the new girl on the mission, as she supposedly saw an alien once, and I like how Camera has her eating by herself here. Weaver was one. She, like I mentioned in the beginning of this podcast, she was working on a film in France, so they were filming a whole bunch of stuff with the soldiers without her being there. They also went through training together. They were already bonded by the time Weaver shows up, and I think that really helps the film, because here's the outsider, Ripley, coming in, and these guys have already bonded, and so it's like, okay, so we're going to throw another thing in the water here. Let's see if it ripples.
Yeah, it doesn't just ripple. It ripples throughout.
Nice.
You set it up.
I've been biting my lip for the last 20 seconds ever since you said it.
It's weird, because I'm one that always rolls my eyes when I hear the stories about, oh, they kept this actor away from this one because of animosity, or they made this group over here, this group over here. But I think in a film like this, I think you feel it, because I do feel like these Space Marines are a unit that have worked together a bunch. I do feel that camaraderie kind of shine through. Even when they're teasing each other, you feel like they've been in missions. You feel like they've been in battles. They've been in some bug hunts. So I totally get it.
And she also comes from an outdated worldview. This is 57 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, they would look at her like we view our grandparents. whether it's political or, and she also has no military background whatsoever.
Yes, I was going to forget this guy, but no. We then see another famous scene from this movie, that of new android Bishop moving his knife up and down both his and Hudson's hands. I thought this was a clever way of introducing the android of the film. It creates great conflict, and Henriksen is another one. Lance Henriksen, he's great in this movie. I thought he embodied this character very well.
Well, he also plays it differently than Ian Holm played Ash.
Mm-hmm.
You can tell these are two different programs for androids. He's much more of a Data than he is a Lore. He is a Star Trek reference because he's a bit more benevolent. But this is one of the most realistic reactions to the movie when she realizes he's an android and she kind of like freaks the fuck out.
Yeah.
Because it's also commenting on prejudice and race relations in a certain way where it's like, I had one bad experience with a black person, so I'm going to demean the whole culture. So there's definitely that there as well. But I like, you know, Henriksen plays it really well. He's given a different type of performance if you look at what he's doing versus what Ian Holm is doing.
Yeah, he definitely differentiates himself. In fact, he wanted to differentiate himself even more. He came in with these contact lenses, and he wanted to be kind of a different kind of android character, and he brought them in, and Cameron filled them like once, and he was like, you know what, they're not going to work, so let's just keep your normal eyes. They work just fine.
I think he's fantastic, and I was trying to think this time. Imagine going into this film not realizing how Bishop was going to act at the end of it, and this adds a level of tension. This is an additional potential antagonist, and it's kind of a red herring throughout. We all know it because this film is so ingrained, but imagine just that first time. You got to think, is he really going to turn? He's a flying ointment throughout this film that you really don't understand, and I like that. I think it's funny that if you pay attention, he's a Hyperdyne system. You go back to Cyberdyne and Hyperdyne, so I think that's just a clever nod there, and he's great. He plays a robot really, really well. I love Lance Henriksen. He's done some great things. We both have relationships with people who have worked much with him.
Mm-hmm. I worked with him.
You worked with him. He's just fantastic, and for all reports, he's also just an absolute sweetheart to deal with, both in a con circuit and professionally.
You forgot his performance in Mangler 2, by the way. That was a great performance of his.
Versus Predator.
Yeah.
I don't mind him in that one.
They should have called that Mangler 2. That Alimony versus Predator based on why he took that.
Yes. Yes. Oh, God. Rico Ross also has a great line here. After Ripley bats the tray away, Ross just goes, I guess she didn't like the cornbread either. Nice. We get some typical Cameron dialogue here as we're hearing assholes and elbows, just like random things being thrown out. We see the ship head to the colony, and one thing I will say about this movie, I've been very complimentary towards it, but one knock I have against it, and I hate that I'm saying this, but in watching it for this review, I cannot not mention it. The effects. When they stay in space, I think the effects hold up remarkably well. It's when characters are in line with the ships, or if they come in for landing. I feel like the effects kind of fall off as compared to the ones from 1979. I see the backdrops. I see everything just kind of in line of, these are all practicals. And I know Cameron was against a time crunch. I know he had to really rush to get this out, but I don't think these effects hold up very well.
Because they don't.
Yeah.
They, you know, we're going to keep discussing that. Some look good, but some of that model work, some of the matte paintings, some of those kind of things. And I know that, look, all the crew on the film absolutely hated him. They absolutely hated and despised James Cameron. They struck in a movie they were working on just because of James Cameron. It's funny because that happens a lot with this asshole. But some of them just, you know what, they're fine, but it's amazing that I can look at a film that is the decade prior still end up looking better. Some of them end up looking hokey, and I gotta say, it affects me and it takes me out of a few scenes.
I will say this much about the strike. What was happening there was they were working with a British crew, and they were really aligned with Ridley Scott. The same crew that pretty much worked with Ridley Scott worked on this film, and they kind of disliked him from the beginning, but of course Cameron's boisterous way of directing didn't help matters, but it really frustrated him when they had mandated tea breaks. We had this tea cart going right in the middle of a scene, and everybody would just kind of take their breaks, and Cameron was like, we're running way behind schedule, we can't be doing this shit. So yeah, he was way not in line with this crew, and it took Weaver to kind of calm things down and kind of level things off. One of the crew, the head of that crew, did end up quitting this production, and yeah, the strike did kind of happen, and it was Weaver who kind of just helped level things off and get everybody cordial again. Thank God she was on the shoot.
It's a good thing James Cameron's Canadian, because if he wasn't, he would have been screaming at him, calling them colonizers. And I'm not going to be as harsh on the effects, because I always appreciate practicality, even if it doesn't hold up to the fullest extent. And there's a lot of movies around this time where I can have that perspective. Like Labyrinth came out the same year. I love that movie. Most of that holds up pretty well, but the matte paintings and some of those things definitely don't. But I appreciate how much of this was actually done by hand. When the only complaint I can have about a movie is that it's doing its job. Because unlike Adam, I don't feel like I'm ever being pulled out of this world, because it's also not too heavy in going overboard with what they're doing with futuristic technology, which that's the kind of stuff that can really throw me off if it's not done the best. Like, as much as I love Total Recall, the Johnny Cab stuff does not hold up.
No.
Which, by the way, Ripley, I mean, these APCs we'll see later on remind me of the ones that Arnold drives when he goes to the humans. The one that he, with the giant drill that he kills the guy with.
Ripley shows that she can drive a loader. I wonder if this is going to come into play later. And you can tell Hicks is already infatuated, as he just can't get the grin off his face as he's looking at her move this loader around. We are seeing all the weapons getting lined up for battle as the Marines are dispensed. And how about these T2 shades?
I mean, it's a precursor. There's a lot of stuff in here. Cameron's career, you can really see the evolution, because a lot of what he did later on in his career, he built off his earlier work. I mean, look, between this and The Abyss,
yeah,
the morphing technology.
Absolutely.
It led to Terminator 2 really being such a pioneering showcase for technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can see the elevation start here for sure.
You have weapons and loaders in this film that we see in Avatar today, but they feel mm-hmm. like an evolved version of what we get here. So yeah, you got to really admire somebody who's like, look, I've built an entire universe and I'm going to keep moving through it time-wise.
They take the express elevator down to hell as the ship heads into the atmosphere and off these effects against clouds. We're hearing that the lieutenant doesn't have any real experience with combat drops. They're getting closer to the atmosphere processor as they circle it and land, as the armored car is now dispensed and the Marines exit. I like how Cameron is giving us a nice overhaul of how these Marines get here. It's not just camera cuts and the Marines are on the move. We're seeing them actually land here.
But again, compared to last time where there was such a long, slow descent to the planet, I feel like this is a faster, more intense scene. And I can appreciate that. Watching them in the drop and watching Paxton in the drop, oh my God, I was thinking of Edge of Tomorrow. Because it's almost the exact same internals of that ship, and it cracked me up. But I think it's good. It feels like we are on a military mission this time, and I think that's important because this is a much different action that they're taking compared to the last one where it was just some space truckers checking something out.
The more energetic pacing is befitting a movie of this type, because it is an action movie, but it's also, it makes sense for them to be moving this quickly, considering that Burke has more on his mind than he's letting on, and he knows some information about the lifespan of these creatures, like the facehuggers, as we'll find out. So I think it makes sense that maybe things are a bit rushed, and perhaps it's the thing why he goes with Gorman. Despite him being relatively inexperienced, he could get things done quickly.
God damn, these guns had to be heavy. Walking around. Oh my God. They enter a bunker, and we have some good suspense being built here. And you know what? Cameron, he has built it to this point, right? We did go through a lot to get here. We had mission briefings. We were having Ripley go through her PTSD. We were having Ripley get convinced to be here. We've gone a long way, and we're finally getting ready to see some aliens. And I think Cameron has built this very well.
You suddenly forget, hey, other than Ripley waking up at the very beginning, like at the 8-minute mark, 6-minute mark, we haven't seen any of this. So this mm-hmm. has been a buildup of the characters, of reintroducing us into our headspace of this world, and bam, now he can start to go.
They turn on their motion trackers, and what a tool Cameron has to build up even more suspense is this thing that we're kind of building up on the device used last week. God, it's going to get used very well throughout the course of this.
This first-person view shot is such a great idea because you can decide from here how you want to use it as opposed to shooting something traditionally. You decide what we get to see of what they are seeing. This is brilliant filmmaking here using these devices.
Well, yeah, perspective is everything. And also, this movie does something that I keep saying Trailblazer, but I have to stand by it. With sequels, it can be very hard to continue to make the threat scary if we've seen them be defeated before, especially when this movie, unlike the first one, they have guns. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of them. But they still manage to find a way. A lot of this because of how Cameron is building it up. The xenomorphs are just as scary in this movie, not just because there's more of them, and it's not hindered by the fact that you feel like the playing field is level because they have guns and can fight back. You know, it's why I like Dream Warriors so much is that, yes, they gave the characters the ability to fight back against Freddy. By the same token, they made Freddy scary again by doing that, though, because he can still dispatch them pretty easily. And you're seeing the same thing here, where, yeah, things are escalated, but not at the expense of your villains.
We go inside a room with some alien samples as Burke unwittingly wakes one up. Nice little scene there. And we're hearing the alien signal get closer as they wander into the hall and fire away. Hicks calls Ripley over, and here is our theatrical introduction to Newt, played by one-and-done actress Carrie Henn. This was her one and only role. And Matt, when we talked Furiosa, I mentioned that there is a child actor who I thought is excellent. In fact, she's one of my favorite characters of all time. I think Carrie Henn, for being a first-time actress, is excellent here. And we'll talk about how she figures into the story, most notably Ripley's, but I can't think of any other actress who had one role, one huge role, and then went on to become a teacher, which is what happened with this girl. But God, is she great here. I love Newt in this movie.
It would have been so easy to have a child here that you end up hating throughout this film. But no, you actually end up rooting for Rebecca throughout. Does the Screech get overdone a little bit? Eh, you know what? She's not Willy, so I don't hate her that way. This is a child actress that not only does a good job, I feel that the characters around her actually care for this child that they come across. You know, not just Ripley, you know, that's the easy one, but I feel like everybody that interacts with her, it feels believable. And part of a lot of that is put on her shoulders. So it's amazing to me that Cameron, of all people, could find a way to get a performance out of a child, because I do not see James Cameron as a person saying, yeah, I'll work with a kid, absolutely. Like, I would think that would just be anathema to his style.
Yeah, especially in 1986. I mean, he was, what, 30 years old at this point. And kudos to him. Matt, you and I have spoken about M. Night Shyamalan and The Sixth Sense. You know, I think Cameron is doing a similar thing here, where this girl is just, he's bringing the best out of her. And people give me a hard time because I say, kids need to die to build up the suspense. But no, I rooted for this girl the entire time because this girl is just giving a remarkable performance.
So there's a lot of bold provocations that you guys have spoused out. I don't think it's the greatest child performance of all time because the 400 Blows exists.
I didn't say of all time. I just said she's good. She's really good here.
Well, on the Furiosa show, you made that claim, or you teased that claim, unless you were referring to somebody else. So I'll give you the opportunity.
No. This is the one I was talking about. I just think it's one of my favorites.
Yeah, I mean, this is not. I'm also more impressed because she had no experience up until this. Like, the fact that it's one and done, I just think she had the natural ability. But this was my same argument for Haley Joel Osment in The Sixth Sense. Like, I think that kid just had natural talent that Shyamalan did not fuck up, like he would with a lot of later movies. And in hindsight, this gives Sam Worthington even less of an excuse in those Avatar for being as bad as he is. 7-year-old girl, or however old
she was, a Terminator movie
with no experience, shows more range than that man has shown in his entire career.
Gorman is having no luck getting through to Newt, or Rebecca, as her real name is. But it's Ripley who gets Newt to say she prefers to be called Newt over Rebecca, and all it took was a little hot chocolate to get this out of her.
This is why I think the daughter part being excluded matters. I'm not saying you need the whole scene, but even if she woke up from cryosleep to be taught that your entire family is gone, your husband and daughter died in XYZ, doesn't matter, I do think that that would have helped this so much. Not that it's bad. I'm not criticizing it. I just think that that emotional punch would have been greater.
I completely agree with you. And I think that's a big reason, again, why Weaver took this role, was because that whole dynamic is something that is important for her character and for Newt's character. But at the same time, we're seeing that she's the mother to this girl, much like we're going to see the queen be the mother to the aliens later, and they're protective the exact same way. So I think the dynamic still works, but as you said, there would be another layer added that I don't think detracts from the film, but I think would have added more to it.
Yeah, I don't think the absence of that scene hinders the theme of motherhood in any way, because so much of it is still intact. I mean, we talk about progression in sequels. Alien is a metaphor for childbirth in a lot of ways, albeit in a perverse, death-inducing type of way. This one is about actual, like, maternal protection. First one's about survival. This one's about fighting to make sure other people survive. Both these characters have lost everything of value. And eventually, we talk about the Vietnam. This is also, by the end of the movie, a reflection of, like, the post-nuclear family. Bishop's the dog. You're looking for that last connection. So I don't think the absence of the daughter hinders this. It would have been nice to keep, but I think there's more than enough here to balance the scales still.
So Ripley wipes the smut off Newt's face and says, hard to believe that there's a pretty girl under all of this. Newt gives some info, like her brother Timmy and her mom and dad, who are all now dead. Ripley goes on to say that the soldiers are here to protect her, and Newt has such a positive outlook as she says, it won't make any difference.
She's a lot like the girl from Battle for Endor, where she accepts the death of her family with with the lack of expression of a serial killer.
Hudson says to stop your grinning and drop your linen as they find the colony on sub-level 3. They make their way to the colony as we're seeing some POV cameras. Very innovative at the time, Adam, as you mentioned earlier. But there's another thing I have to ding this movie on. One name we haven't mentioned is H.R. Giger. Adam, you mentioned the book, but Cameron did say, while he called Giger at the beginning to ask if he wanted to be a part of this production, he never really got a call back, and Giger ended up taking Poltergeist 2. I feel the influence of Giger last week, as each new place they went to had a kind of pervy, massive scale feel to it, is sorely missing. The design work here is good, but I'm really missing Giger. Cameron said that in the end, him and Hurd decided not to bring him aboard because he kind of wanted to bring his own stamp to this franchise. And then, like I said, Giger was on Poltergeist 2 anyway, but I don't think Giger ever forgave Cameron for leaving him out of this movie. And frankly, I think this movie could have used his stamp, because as it is, these worlds all kind of look the same to me. Adam, as the big Giger fanboy, how do you feel about the absence of him here?
Now, two minds. One, I feel it's smart that Giger was not brought on board, because I think him and James Cameron probably would have killed each other after about 2 weeks on set. Like, I literally think they would have chopped each other up into pieces.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, I find less pervy sexual feel to the aesthetic. Now, that's a massive part of Giger's work, obviously, for those that don't know. Go watch Dark Star, the documentary. But I do feel like we are seeing more biomechanical as we go through everything here. So I'm of two minds. I see much more biomechanical work. I see the rib cage on the ceiling. I see a lot of that, but I do miss just that psi-sexual just dirtiness that you feel from Giger's work.
I will say, though, a lot of the production design, while it's not as pervy or overtly phallic, there is an internal consistency to it, so I feel like I'm still in the same world.
As they make their way in, Ripley says that they are under the heat exchangers, and if they fire, they could rupture the cooling system. And this creates even more conflict, as the team refutes the idea that they can't use pulse rifles here, and they're stuck using harsh language, which is another great Rico Ross line. They find some pods and some face huggers as Ripley tells Newt to sit up front. They find a survivor who tells the crew to please kill her, and after an hour and a half of teasing us, we have our first chest burster. And Weaver's great here, because we know exactly what she's thinking as she watches the monitor and sees this thing hatch. Now it's on.
Absolutely. And the thing is, you know, you got to assume that people had watched first one before this, so this just ratchets it up, that terror. For an action movie, this is a horror scene moment. This is the slasher scene here, which I don't think exists again, but this just, oh, it's frightening.
This is also why I'm happy the Dallas scene was cut from the first Alien, because it would have telegraphed what's about to happen here with the cocoon.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a great point. So they end up taking a flamethrower to it, and we're seeing some aliens move around, and Hudson is getting multiple signals that something's moving, which isn't them.
That right there, when the flamethrower goes off, because we only had one last week. It's Alien. The fact that it's pluralized it, which, fuck Hollywood for all the pluralization of titles that come out since.
Yeah.
But that this looks like frickin' when you turn on a light and you see bugs scurry. When that flamethrower hits, it feels just slimy and dirty watching these frickin' xenomorphs on the ceiling and on the wall start to move.
Yeah, I like how this, they're like literal cockroaches.
Yes, exactly.
Definitely. Exactly. But not in the AVP way where they feel like disposable cannon fodder.
Yep.
Because this one really takes advantage of the fact that they have acid blood as a defense mechanism.
Do they? I don't see that.
Yeah.
Because we see one person get hit with it and burn his face, but I don't feel like Cameron is taking us full advantage, because in last week, we saw this fucking blood just go through a ship, and they were so scared that the thing was going to blow up. Here, we're not seeing any of that, and besides one scene, I didn't feel that at all.
That's because they're on a little dinger, but also, it's fortuitous that if they had the pulse rifles, they could just incinerate these things, like, no questions asked. But because they have to use, like, conventional, non-battery, actual guns in our style, that threat is still there. You gotta make sure you shoot them from a distance.
We see one alien attack as Wrzbowski dies, and shots are going off, and Hudson says that they're coming from the walls. Ripley loses it and gets in the driver's seat to take off. She's driving through the hall, so the aliens are attacking, and I have another gripe. Why aren't these aliens as slimy as last week's aliens? Again, the design work in this movie is just lacking. Like, I'm not feeling like these are the same things from last week.
I have a little bit of a beef with that, too, because not only do I have slight issues with the way that they look, because I do think that the evolution, life cycle, I think we lose that continuity quite a bit But I also have an issue with how some of them die, because some of these xenomorphs explode when shot, and it comes across a few of these deaths as pretty freaking hokey while some of these aliens are dying. Because if something with acid blood blows up next to me, I would expect that I'd be eaten away by that acid. Sometimes the acid's there, sometimes it's not, and it bugs me. Not to make a joke about it, but it bugs me that the inconsistency of how the xenomorphs die.
I kind of look at it as like an isolated incident in a lot of ways. Unless I was going to get a full sequence of like, this is the actual like recorded emphatic life cycle of the xenomorphs, I'm not bothered by the design changes throughout this entire franchise. They never look consistent from movie to movie. So this at least kicks that trend off. And it doesn't bother me because I'm like, okay, there's just more of them and maybe they're not as... Could be because of, like, lack of nutrients. I'm coming up with headcanon to why it doesn't bother me, because it's... They're also shot in the dark a lot. It's not the first Jeepers Creepers movie where I think that movie's fucking scary for the first half, but the minute he shows up in the headlights, I'm like, okay, which episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer did you come from? I don't have that here.
And going to Matt's point, I do like that Drake gets burned by the acid blood. Cameron hasn't forgotten that bit of a defense mechanism from the first film, and we're seeing it here. They get in the car and Ripley takes off again. One gets in the driver's seat, and I do love the scene of Ripley running the alien down. I thought that was nice. Ripley asks Newt if she's okay, and she just gives a thumbs up. Ripley has the idea to head up and nuke the colony from the air. This is agreed upon by everyone, but of course Burke, who wants to preserve it. And this is the first sign to me that Burke is the actual villain and not Bishop.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I feel like they found a way to put Mother in a human body with Burke. And part of that I appreciate, because he never gets emotional in any way, but it's very, hey, you know, let's think about this here. So it works out really well.
Yeah, you can always tell he's thinking about the asset. It's still that same modus operandi that Mother had in the first movie, where it's like, everyone else is expendable as long as you get the sample. This is where I think Resident Evil got the Umbrella Corporation from, because they're so similar. Not just because in a lot of ways they're both ultimately incompetent.
Burke says that Hicks can't make that kind of decision because he's just a grunt. No offense. More bad effects as they try to board the ship, but slime is found on the landing cycle and we just see the ship crash right near the crew. This is a great scene as it happens on the ship, but not as it crashes near our crew. I just love how this alien on the ship also looks. This is the first time we're seeing the slime drip from its jaws and it attacks this pilot. This one looked really good.
I also love how this movie takes for the Empire Strikes Back sequel playbook of nothing works on a technology level.
Yes.
Everything is breaking down. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of ways, James Cameron always talks about how, oh, if I made Jurassic Park, I would have made it like Aliens. This part is basically when the power gets cut at the park. So I really can see, I don't know if Crichton was visualizing Aliens when he was writing that story, but I definitely see the through line of how he could have translated this to dinosaurs. And the world would have been better for it, once again, for the record.
As Hudson expresses his fright, Newt gives the most haunting quote of the film. They mostly come out at night, mostly.
One of them should have said, oh yeah, we have something similar on our world. They're called prostitutes.
They start going through their weapons as Newt plays with the flamethrower. Hudson is just bitching away, and Ripley says that Newt survived with no weapons or training as she gives a salute. And this is a scene I would normally scoff at, but a couple reasons I'm not here. One, I just love the character of Newt. And two, it inspires one of my favorite lines of the movie, as Hudson just says, well, then why don't you just put her in charge?
Can you imagine if this movie was made nowadays? There would be think pieces about the whole scene where Hicks shows Ripley how to work the rifle.
Yep.
About how, of course, the man needs to show her how to do it. It's like, no, because she actually has no military training, so this
is for
it. I mean, there's a reason this movie is used as kind of the quote-unquote strong female character in the best way. Like, this is the, I still think, the gold standard, not just because there's a Goldstein in this movie. But this was my problem with Terminator 2. I don't like that Sarah Connor, Linda Hamilton got all bulked up in the argument, oh, she was in prison. I'm like, no, she was in a psych ward. She probably would have been a lot more strained. Here, Sigourney didn't hit the gym in between movies. And you also have the literal stereotypical butch type of female action hero with Vasquez. I think that's also very intentional.
Ripley tells Hudson to call up a floor print file as they need to find a way into this complex. Ripley is still not on board with Bishop. We're seeing her still doubt his motivations. I am liking how Cameron is always focused on Newt as she tries to get a peek at what the crew is doing, but there's always something or someone in the way. He does a lot of POV shots here, and I like that. We're definitely seeing some sparks between Hicks and Ripley. As you mentioned, Matt, he's showing her how to work this rifle, and my God, this took a lot of convincing. on James Cameron's part to get her to do this, because, as I said, she is anti-gun, and he had to take her aside and explain to her the exact reasons why. And if he gives one of my favorite quotes, where when she finally decides that, okay, I'll go ahead and do it, Cameron goes, "Another liberal bites the dust." She did really not like to, when this movie had come out, and she felt like, again, it was kind of a mother defending her child in a way. All anybody wanted to talk about was how she outgunned Arnold and how she is the bigger action hero than Arnold or Stallone from that year. And she didn't like all the comparisons that were made, but again, it's for the character, and I think for the character it works.
It's also the problem with film advertising, in that saying that is completely misrepresenting the movie and her character. And for the record, clearly those people were not watching Schwarzenegger or Stallone in the mid-80s, because I think Schwarzenegger kills more people in Commando than the entire population of Massachusetts.
And of course you had Cobra come out that year too. Hicks gives Ripley a locator as a precaution, and he does follow it up with saying, it doesn't mean we're engaged or anything. Ripley tucks Newt in as she gives the locator just given to her to Newt. And Ripley starts putting together, with all the aliens they've seen, they must have come from an egg. So where's that source? Cameron's kind of pointing out here what the audience must be thinking.
Yeah, because it was never explained before. But to a point, the last movie, we just had the eggs. And even going through and rewatching it and seeing it as many times, I never questioned it. So it's amazing that he at least came up with a question that I don't think people thought of. It's giving you what you don't even know you were thinking about until he does.
Which is the definition of a good sequel. Yeah. You know.
Well, it's also back when James Cameron, this is again why I'm disappointed by the Avatar movies. So much of the detail in those films are about the world and how like the creatures work, not necessarily logic when it comes to how the characters perceive the world. And it's the opposite here. I think that's all the better for it.
Ripley also puts together that the eggs are being requested to be preserved by Burke, who wants to take them home and, what, make scrambled eggs out of them? Always the slimy corporate guy, but what I like about this, I guess we can say heel turn, is that it's not like it's a 180, right? This has been the character all along, we just haven't seen it.
Oh yeah, we've never seen him when he's in his element in strictly the corporate world. We've only seen him through Ripley's eyes. So it also makes her look smart for putting this together, because if she didn't call this, she would look like a moron. Like, it'd be the equivalent of Austin not realizing Vince McMahon was the higher power back in 1999. It also recontextualized the movie where Burke is the true villain. Because of his indecisiveness, he got everyone in that colony killed. It's not an obvious villain reveal, but I'm also glad that the movie never tries to misdirect you into thinking that Burke is a good person. Because, like, that would have been the easy thing to do, is try to make you think, oh, he's a good guy. Like, he never picks up a gun and saves Ripley and says, now you owe me one, or you never see him do anything that heroic. He's always in the background.
Yeah, absolutely. There's people that distrust him the whole time, but he's never twisting a mustache. He's just kind of matter of fact, and I think that makes him just that much more realistic as a villain, even.
There's also one more thing. This movie, in a lot of ways, is reflective of films we were getting at this time. You know, I mentioned RoboCop, Garrett, when we talked about Exorcist 3. This movie is also a staunch criticism of institution, of the military, of corporations, particularly ones that are going overseas. You can look at things like China or Japan trying to extort their business into America. There's a lot of stuff here that Cameron is shining a light on, which in all honesty is what science fiction should do first and foremost. That's why I don't view this strictly as a balls-to-the-wall action film, even though there's a lot of shooting and there is a big fight at the end.
Ripley questions Burke about the killing of the colonists as she says that he sent them right to their death. Again, Reiser is just so great here. Burke tells Ripley that he thought she was smarter than this, and she responds, "Happy to disappoint you." And this also lets Burke off the hook as being the one that compromises the mission. Burke says that it's 4 hours until the ship blows up, and then overload is inevitable at this point. Ripley suggests getting the other dropship from the Sulaco. She also suggests getting a portable transmitter to remote pilot the ship, and Bishop volunteers to go himself. Fuck this crawl space, by the way, that Bishop goes through. Oh, God damn. How far did he have to go here? 200 yards or something?
Yeah, well, it's like when Tim Robbins has to climb out of the Shawshank.
Yeah.
They say the length of, like, 5 football fields, which is the most unrealistic thing in that movie. Not just the fact that he dug a hole. Well, we'll talk about this in, what, 20 years?
Two, maybe.
Also, like, Bishop has one of the great lines where he's like, "Believe me, I prefer not to. I may be synthetic, but I'm not stupid."
Yes. That is a great line. Ripley goes and curls up next to Newt. We get some force lightning as Bishop straps in and enables some controls. Ripley wakes up and is attacked by a facehugger. The suspense of this scene is magnificent, but fuck me running if this is yet another effect whose seams you can just see through. When Ripley is interacting with this thing, it doesn't look as vibrant as last week.
You can say that, but also the facehuggers were arguably the weakest effect in the first Alien once it burst out of Kane.
Very true.
I think this scene is just astounding. I think it's tense as all hell, having Ripley and Newt trapped together. I mean, this is just... See, it's tough, because the facehuggers are obviously pornographic in its design. So to do this with a kid is really borderline pushing some stuff. But I think that the suspense, the terror, and that they're trapped in this room is just so damn good. But the sound, the lighting, everything in here is top. I love this scene.
Speaking of sound, the fact it's a soundproof room, because there's that to the other side of the window and it's them yelling and no one else can hear them. So it's literally, it's in a closed space, no one can hear you scream.
And Burke kind of cements himself as the huge villain of the story too, because when they're doing that, he turns off the monitor. That's just pure sleaze. He's gone from sleaze to borderline killer at this point.
Oh, yeah, he's now Cohagen from Total Recall.
I mean, and there's two of them, so he wants Ripley and Newt both to be impregnated with these, which means he's probably looking to sacrifice the Marines.
Newt tells Ripley to break the glass. She can't, but she does use her lighter, established when we see her smoking earlier in the film, to turn on the sprinkler system and alarm.
This is the only pro-smoking movie you will ever find.
And the water in this room, it just adds so much suspense.
The tagline should have been, save a life, shoot a light.
Jesus, you had me until that. Hicks jumps through the glass as Hudson and Vasquez shoot up the facehugger, and this is when Burke is ratted out as preserving the freezers and getting one of them impregnated so that he can take the aliens home for a profit. And it's here where the lights go out, and Hudson has another good zinger here. Someone says they cut the power, and Hudson responds with, how can they cut the power, man? They're animals.
And every time Hudson's line, so I have the Aliens pinball on my PlayStation. It's a four-pack of Alien pinball games on there. I love digital pinball. But all of the lines are Hudson.
Of course.
Like every single one. And of course, you know, it finishes with a game over, man. But every line is Hudson, and that's it.
They investigate the area as the aliens are getting close. They're shown as being inside. And when this hatch is open, we're seeing a ton of the aliens come towards the camera. This is a wonderful reveal. I think Horner's selling it with his score, despite what Adam says. But when you look at these aliens moving towards the camera, you see dozens of seams. And this, I think, shows the power of having one alien as opposed to hundreds. Yes, you have upped the stakes, but at what cost, especially with 1986 effects at their disposal? Still, I'm not going to take away from the power of this scene's intent. It's still effective. I'm just, again...
I will also say this looks much better before the days of 4K and digital restoration. I think this is one of those things that looked a lot better on its initial DVD release. When you change the color grading and the lighting with these big Blu-ray releases, you're going to notice more of it. I guess
that's a good point.
Compatibility with how modern digital photography will recontextualize how things look.
I love this. I mean, this is the most intense air duct scene since Die Hard. To me, this is putting your head in a crawl space under your house and just seeing a swarm of insects coming at you.
Yeah.
Still not the creepiest scene in the film, though. We'll get that later.
No,
go ahead.
But, like, within this 10 minutes, if you were someone who likes Alien because of the horror tinge, I think you're getting your fill here.
Yeah.
They fall into the room, and can I say I just love the sounds of these pulse rifles? Adam, you mentioned the Foley work earlier. I mean, I love these sounds.
And they're iconic, that sound. To Matt's point of playing this on the arcade game, I remember holding the pulse rifle at the Aliens arcade game and just that sound and the reverb kick you get from it. And it's paired with the screeching of the Xenos as they're getting shot and stuff. But this is where I got issues, though, that you're shooting these acid-filled creatures and you're not having a result of the acid. And some of them are literally exploding as they're getting shot. I find some of the Xeno kills pretty damn hokey. I hate using that word, but I do. In a movie that I love so much, I'm like, rewatching it for this, it just struck me how many times, for some reason, Cameron filmed an alien model just blowing up.
Yeah.
I will also say, I'm also about as harsh on it because I'm the only person on the station who watched every episode of the original Star Trek run and has seen basically everything Roger Corman has ever made. So I am much more forgiven when it comes to how things are disposed of in genre films.
Burke slams the door on Ripley and Newt as Hudson just takes out a ton of aliens while talking shit. But his death may be my favorite of the entire film. He just gets sucked underneath the floor. Just remarkable. He's still talking shit as he's going under.
I love it. He's just talking shit the whole way down.
Yeah. Burke moves around, and of course he's taken out in a hideous way, but a way that makes the audience cheer for his death. Of course you had to have the slimy corporate guy get taken out this way, and I loved it.
Yep.
But there's also the one scene I wish they kept is when she gives him the grenade.
Yep. Newt is leading the way as Hicks communicates with Bishop. Newt gets lost as Vasquez runs way low on ammo. She's using her handgun to fend off an alien as her and Drake are back to back. And I like the way Cameron has them go out. They're two soldiers with an explosive history, and they go out while taking a few aliens with them. Just nice symmetry.
I forgot that we eliminated our entire cast in Wave. You know, the first time that we come across the Xenomorphs, we basically eliminate down to our five or six. And then right here, we eliminate everybody but our core three that are going to be left. I had forgotten that this wipes out everybody else except for Ripley, Hicks, and Newt, and Bishop doing his thing. But this is it. I mean, and he really stages it well to cut down your cast to get who you got to get.
This avoids the problem of, oh, a team of Marines lose to a bunch of bugs. You don't feel like the Marines are devalued because they're getting taken out. But it also follows the alien model. It spaces out when people die. It's just in bigger chunks because there's more characters.
It's the slasher thing, right, Matt?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Newt then falls, and Hen did say this was her favorite part of the shoot, was going down the slide over and over. Go ahead.
Nope, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and to those who say this isn't a horror film, look at the way Cameron composes this shot of the alien appearing in the water behind her. It's freaky as fuck.
When I think of this film, there's a lot, but I don't know if there's a better shot than this alien coming out of the water. This is iconic. This is frightening. This is horror. This is thriller. This is drama. I mean, this is astoundingly composed, shot, colored, lit. This, whatever you want to call 10-15 seconds, is a masterpiece right here. It is everything about this film that I hold dear, is this shot out of the water.
Jaws was the movie that turned off people swimming. I'm pretty sure if you saw a xenomorph, you would never go back in the water either.
And Hen did say that, like, this guy was really good with her, where he's just like trying to make sure that she knows that he's a good guy and this is just for the movie. Don't forget, you have like a, what, 8-9-year-old girl at this point. We have the tracker as well as the suspense of whether they'll be able to cut through the metal on time to save Newt. And Cameron cuts away almost as soon as this alien appears behind her. So we don't know her fate at this point.
No, and Hicks, this movie's hardcore enough to lead you to think that they would kill her off.
Hicks takes Ripley and tells her he believes Newt is alive, but they have to move on. He shoots an alien in the elevator as acid once again appears on his clothes. Ripley gears up to go after Newt. Man, the franticness of the next half hour is absolutely glorious. I love the ship once again keeping us in the loop of what's going on. Horner's score is just mounting the tension, and Weaver is just so damn good as another woman who's here to protect not necessarily her daughter, but to make up for the loss of her own. Just great stuff being done here. Cameron's built it to a great climax.
This is also one of the great unconventional ticking clock type of third acts, where there's literally not a self-destruct button going off, but you feel like there is one because of what's been established already. Like, this is very much like the trench run from A New Hope.
Yeah, we're running in that elevator straight to hell. We are peaked and we're just ready to go. And we haven't even got our massive reveal. Imagine not knowing what's coming. But we did set up the time frame of what's going to happen, the explosions and this thing basically going to hell. And, I mean, this is pretty damn great. And then they're about to, or they do just take out the person, of course, who's going to defend Ripley. Suddenly it's Ripley. You know, you think it's going to be these two joining together to get out of here, and no, they take him out of commission.
So Ripley wanders around, shoots a flame or two with this flamethrower. She rescues Newt, and then the breathing starts, and we have the slow reveal of the other mother in this movie, the Queen Alien. Look, this egg factory of a creature is a glorious concept, and the way these eggs are just moving until they're planted is amazing. And when Cameron keeps the shots short, this creature is quite effective. Like, the way it growls at both of them, I love that. And the use of sound, just amazing. But goddamn, once it detaches and takes off for them, the less than stellar effects once again take center stage. But until then, this is a fucking amazing looking creature. And the concept that was Cameron's himself. He's the one who came up with this. He drew it. He designed it. And I do love the concept. But if he had waited a couple years, I think it would have been much more effective.
This is my one problem. And I can't believe I'm saying this. It's not for the effects. This is a personal pet peeve of mine. Not that I would keep one of these in my house. But when it comes to sci-fi, I don't like when you have pre-established races or swarms. And then it's revealed, oh, there's a hierarchy and they have a leader, a hive mind. Adam, you've seen First Contact, right?
Yep.
I hate the Borg Queen in concept. I don't like that the Borg, again, my nerdy high horse, I don't like that you have this thing, this entity that takes away your identity and makes you a part of the hive, but yet you still report to an official leader. Here, it's kind of the same thing, not to that degree, but it's fine. It's just not something I've ever felt like the xenomorphs needed. It's scarier just as, like, mindless drones.
Interesting. My second big surprise of this. Wow. Adam, how do you feel?
I feel that this is why Cameron did not want Giger coming in, because I think he wanted the credit for the Alien Queen. That's just been my thought, because I think you suddenly got rights issues and shit like that when you're creating something like this. I think she looked glorious in shots. It's amazing. You get that hood over it. You have this double mouth done that way. I think he's trying to create some female sexual imagery the way that HR does with the male sexual imagery. But yeah, to the points, in quick shots, it's like, oh man, that's awesome. When it lingers a little bit, it's like, maybe not. No.
Yeah.
And people, I will say, don't Google search ovipositor. Just don't do it.
Or make sure you have safe browsing turned off.
Safe search on.
And there's also the thing, Cameron, even in the first Terminator movie, there's some shots when you see the full exoskeleton that are kind of janky, and this has a similar thing.
It is hard to not appreciate, because if you do not know this is coming, this is such an amazing climax.
Agreed. You know why I love this, too, is because it's the perfect enhancement to a sequel, because it doesn't take away from the last film. This doesn't take away from anything that Alien did in Alien. This is just a way of Cameron explaining where the alien comes from, and I don't have a problem with that.
Now that Disney has it, we're going to get a freaking Alien Queen prequel one day.
Just gosh, dang it. Fucking stop it.
Pretty sure we're going to get that in a month and a half.
Damn. I have feelings. Mm-hmm. Ripley unloads all she's got. This is just really two mothers protecting their young. Love the counter that tells us how many bullets are left on the gun. More suspense. Ripley fights her way out, and by the time she gets outside, Bishop is not there. But there he is, rising out of the hole, and my God, what a music cue. Fuck you, Adam. Bishop flies out of danger.
There's parts where the music cue do really well. It's just choppy as the water in Jaws.
Bishop flies out of danger, bat clouds and all, as the place completely explodes. Now, we couldn't have our heroes get away that easily, could we?
I like that there's a few seconds where you do think the android betrayed them again. And that's it doesn't point. Linger, but it's just enough for you to go, wow, she was right. And then it's just really quick, it's over. It's a good little pause.
Yeah, especially because it would have been logical for Burke to put a failsafe if he died.
Exactly,
but yeah.
It would flip a switch and change his prerogative.
Yep.
So as they land and make all pleasantries, Bishop has a claw penetrate right through his chest, and as someone who had seen this before the first one, God, was I confused. This fucking milk is going everywhere. But fuck, what a moment, and Hendrickson sells it as if he is flat out dying. This is great.
You'd think 57 years in the future they would have invested in oil at least.
Right? Ripley distracts the queen as she gets to safety, and then she gets inside one of the loaders to show it who's boss. Again, this is Cameron doing something that 1986 effects can't really pull off, though the get away from her you bitch moment is definitely a stand up and cheer moment.
Yeah, I mean, this is the line that sold the movie in a lot of ways. And
yep.
If the Oscars weren't so uptight, this would have been the clip they played. But look, this line is so iconic, even J.K. Rowling used it in Harry Potter. Right?
Did she really?
Yeah, and the last one, Ron's mom, not my daughter, you bitch.
Yep.
Oh, wow.
That she kills Helena Bonham Carter.
Barely remember that.
That was a stand-up and cheer moment. Like, I've been to football games that weren't that loud, for the record.
But we're getting cutbacks and obviousness of the fight. It detracts from it, though they do their best with this. I like the whipping tail. That's pretty cool. How do you guys feel about the fight here?
It doesn't bother me. I mean, it's no less awkward than watching a Hulk Hogan match in 1986. The work rate is pretty comparable, and Ripley does more selling than Hogan ever did, so
good job on that.
You're just insulting everything I like in this podcast, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. I think I'm big Stevie shit on the 80s in this.
It doesn't bug me. It's weird. There's some times where I'm like, this comes across as pretty hokey. When I'm into it and I'm just really charged up, I'm like, okay, great. The tail whipping back and forth, I think, is really good. And yeah, I mean, thank goodness that Ripley freaking sells this so well. The double mouth, there's times where I'm like, why does this look a little awkward? Why does this look like they changed it a little bit? So I do get one or two moments, but I really don't care, because when she's in that power loader, hit the music, cue the pyro, and let's fucking go. It's classic.
More wrestling metaphors here than we had in Thunderdome.
Yeah, but on our own site, we have the liberty to make these references without fear of being sued.
Very true. So Ripley falls through the hall and lands right on top of the alien, but as she climbs up, the alien emerges. She opens the airlock, and damn if I don't laugh every time that bust of Bishop moves across the ground. But you know what? This is a heroic moment for him, too, because he saves Newt.
Yeah. Yep.
So that's a very nice showing of this character not being what we thought he was. But the alien once again gets launched into space as Ripley closes the hole.
In the same way we saw last week.
But you know what? It's great symmetry, though, because it's launched into space.
It is, but you're still establishing the precedent that the only way to kill these things is to suck them out of an airlock.
Well, what are you going to do, though? What are you going to do with this goddamn loader that can barely hold it without this thing getting loose?
Because he could have easily recreated what he did with the Terminator, where he kills it with a compressor, like a giant press machine.
I'm glad he didn't.
But that's the only other thing you could think. You'd have to find some thing to either crush it or behead it.
It's hard to ignore that literally it is floating out of an airlock the exact same way that it was in the first one.
Well, that'll change next week. Stay tuned. So Ripley and Newt hug, as Bishop says, not bad for a human.
Oh.
Ripley opens up the pods, and in go Mother Ripley, Daughter Newt, Dad Hicks, and I guess Drunk Uncle Bishop?
No, he's the dog.
He's the dog, okay.
To me, it's Uncle Hicks.
Yeah, Uncle Hicks, okay. That final shot gets me every time. The family unit she so craved is here as credits roll on Aliens, something that David Fincher will shit on next week, but we're not there yet.
Preview that.
How do you guys feel about this final shot? It's a little obvious, but I love it. It gets me chills every time I see it because Ripley's gotten what she wants.
It's funny that Cameron, for all his action and all his wanton stuff, that he finds ways to do sappy endings because, yeah, he does it again here. He does it multiple times in action films.
Yeah, Terminator is the same thing where there's some optimism. And much like that, the third film of these franchises, take a shit on that.
Yep, we'll get to that next week. But until then, scale of 1 to 10, how do we feel about Aliens? Adam?
You know, I knew this was going to be an interesting discussion coming through, because when everybody talks about what are the best sequels of all time, what sequel's better than the film that came before, this is one of the three or four that are talked about. Aliens is a masterpiece for a reason that I don't think a lot of people look at, is that it changed what made Alien great by just becoming a different genre of film. As opposed to a sci-fi thriller horror, this is a sci-fi action film. It's got some horror elements, and those almost feel like a tribute to the first one, but this is, it's a sci-fi action film. That's really what this is. James Cameron put some stamps in this film that we are going to see through everything that he does going forward, and love it or hate it, it's full-blown James Cameron. I think Sigourney Weaver is tremendous in this film. I think our young lady that plays Newt, Rebecca, is tremendous film. I think what we get from our entire supporting cast are great archetype of different characters. They're thought out, but they're quick, simple, and we move on without having to dwell too much. The story coincides with the first one well. We've moved from Mother to the company, the corporation, and I think that fits well. I can't say this is a better film than Alien. I won't. There are times where this is the film I'm in the mood to watch more. There are times where I want an action movie more than a drama. I want a quicker paced film as opposed to a slower paced film, so it's tough to judge them that way. I do think this film is absolutely fantastic. I love it. It's meaningful for me and my best friend to sit and watch Aliens. It's meaningful for me and my dad to talk about xenomorphs and shit, because we just always have. So yeah, this thing's great, but I do have issues with some of the effects work here and there, some of the hokey shots that I talked about. I'm going to place this, and this may be controversial, but I'm going to place it under Alien, and I'm going to score it under Alien. I almost scored them the same, but ranked it differently, but I do think I'm going to give it a fair ranking. It's a ridiculously strong 8. But it's an 8 on 10, probably as strong as I can go. But I got enough issues that I'm not going to give it a 9. So, good, strong 8 on 10. I love this film.
Despite the shitty score, according to you.
Despite the Cuisinart score. <Yeah. laughs> I'm standing up for James Horner.
Matt.
Well, somebody has to stand up for him since Bishop lost his legs.
Oh, shit.
So, I think Adam's point talks about this movie is repeatedly discussed in the French sequels that are better than the original. For me, it's not a question of which is better. I think this is one of those times where it's more preference than filmmaking, because I think both this and Alien are masterfully told and executed with what they set out to do. They just set out to do entirely different things, which is what I champion for sequels in their inception. So on that preference front, I do prefer this to Alien in almost every capacity, but that's just based on my sensibilities and what I like. I think this is still the best thing James Cameron has ever made. I think this is his finest hour as a director, as a storyteller. It's everything he does well, and my issues with him seem to be toned down comparatively. Largely also wasn't on set and didn't have to deal with his nonsense, so take that for what it's worth. Everything this movie champions, you know, that I've discussed, it's touchstone on being a slasher film, what it did for depicting women in action films, how it's been reassessed as one of the most important blockbusters ever made, because this is a blockbuster in the sense we think of nowadays. It just so happens that it's also a slow burn of world building and PTSD, structuring, showing that every role matters in a movie, which I think is lost all too often. It's one of the most quotable movies ever made. Again, when my only complaint is just complaining about the effects that have lost their luster 40 years later, I can't call that damning in my assessment of the overall movie. So this is in my top 10 of favorite movies ever, and I don't think there's a movie in this franchise that even comes close. I certainly respect Alien for what it is, but it doesn't have that impact on me. And it's weird, Garrett, you know, because when we did the Terminator shows, I said I vastly prefer the first Terminator to the second one because it's more horror-centric and less polished, less action-heavy. And the reason why I don't have that issue here, which is weird because, you know, Alien is much more of a, like what the first Terminator is, certainly with look and polish, is that this one doesn't have the overshine and 90s excessive polish that I think Judgment Day had for a movie of that ilk. It was a bigger sequel, but it also felt too bombastic that I felt detached from the first film in a certain way. This one, I don't have that. I feel like this is a natural progression. It's not too far into being futuristic like Star Trek or even Starship Troopers with the absurdity of the action for something that takes place 60 years after the original. So doesn't matter the cut, this is getting a 10 for me no matter any way you slice it. And I hate that I'm giving so many 10s this year, but goddamn.
I was going to say, wow.
But look, I mean, look, we've covered The Road Warrior as a special movie for me. We did Raiders. It's not like I'm giving these movies to little niche. But it also shows just how much I love the 80s. Like, I think if I did my top 100 favorite movies, I'm pretty sure the biggest chunk would come from this decade. They wouldn't all be action movies, like my scores are notating. Aliens, Road Warrior, Raiders. But yeah, this is every bit as advertised, and when the 40th anniversary comes around, I hope they re-release it in theaters like they just did with Alien.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. Although I'm not with you on the score. I'm more in line with Adam here in that, don't get me wrong, I love this movie. I can put this movie on anytime. This is the definition of grab a bag of popcorn, fucking turn this on, and just have a blast with it. But I prefer the elegance of last week's film. And when people talk about Alien as opposed to Aliens, Alien is the elegant one. Aliens is the adrenaline one. Still, though, going into this viewing, I didn't think I would love it as much as I do. And I do really, really, really like this movie. But some of the effects and some of the decisions that Cameron made don't really ring true with me. Still, we have Hudson here. You can't hate a movie that has Hudson in it. And Weaver is giving a really good performance here that would catapult her the next year. She would do some of her passion projects like Gorillas in the Mist, and she would be in Working Girl the next year where she would get another Oscar nomination. She really cemented herself with this movie that she had reservations about doing. And I think the movie is all about Sigourney, and that is why she is my favorite actress, is because of what she does in this film. Newt is a tremendous character. I love the symmetry that goes with Ripley and motherhood that comes with Newt. And even the symmetry of Ripley and the alien queen. They're both mothers. They're both fighting for the survival of their young. I think that is all amazingly done that Cameron doesn't linger on. We see the shot at the very end of the movie. That is literally the time where you feel, oh my gosh, she is finally getting her family unit here. Some of the effects take me out of it, but yet we have Bishop, we have Vasquez, we have a whole line of quote-unquote grunts that enhance this vision very well. I could have preferred more slime. I could have preferred the entrance of H.R. Giger, but at the same time, you cannot hate this movie. This is an adrenaline rush to the nth degree, and I am with Adam. I have the same exact score written down. I have an 8 written down, but it is a very, very, very strong 8. I really like this movie. And Matt, this makes two movies that we have reviewed in the last couple months where I feel like it is up there as one of the best action films ever made. We talked about Fury Road. This is more science fiction, more horror, but I view it as almost an action film too with the way these aliens are attacking. So yeah, I have a strong 8 out of 10 for Aliens. Now, this last 2 weeks, we have reviewed two movies that are pretty much universally praised. Next week starts the trend of alien movies that are not as well loved. It is a very maligned film. I'm talking Alien 3. It's a film that definitely has its defenders. And out of all the films we are reviewing in this retrospective, I'm looking forward to next week's movie the most because I think it could be the more divisive discussion. Matt, what are you expecting when we review David Fincher's Alien 3 next week?
It's probably going to be divisive because I don't think we've ever discussed it, even in our circle, but it's not the show I've been anticipating the most. I'll save that for further down the road. I've only seen it a couple times. These other two movies I know almost like the back of my hand. This one I know like the clothes in the back of my closet where I pretend they don't exist. And every time I look at them, I kind of cringe because I think of bad memories where it's like, oh, I can't believe I used to wear that. And it's funny you mentioned David Fincher's Alien 3 because this is a movie even he disowns, despite the fact that it's more of a David Fincher movie than you would expect. Like, it's got a lot of his trademarks. But I'm excited to talk about it because you're right. This is where this franchise starts to hit some choppy waters.
Now, Adam, I know you and I over the years have discussed this film at length, and I am excited to actually be on a podcast with you where we actually get to talk about it formatively for a wide audience. What are you expecting when we get to Alien 3 next week, Pepsi commercial and all?
I think we're going to make more than one reference to the classic sitcom Rock. I think I finally get to delve into maybe some notes that I had many years ago when I was writing up from music videos to motion pictures and the directors we had that crossed over, because David Fincher was one of my favorite music video directors. He has some just absolute classic bangers and some amazing pieces of cinema and music videos. This could have killed a career, the response of it. Not talking about the quality, we're going to get into that, but this could have made him go right back to Madonna and Nine Inch Nail, you know, and just and go back into doing that kind of stuff. So this is going to be, I think, a pretty interesting discussion because it's going to be an assembly of ideas, put it that way. But yeah, this is the movie that I think when people talk about the maligned alien films, this is kind of where it starts for everybody. But I think it continues from here. So I think part of that discussion is going to be, how did we get two of the most celebrated sci-fi, two of the most celebrated horror films, and how did we go right off the rails with only the third iteration?
So you're saying it's literally like David Fincher's Fight Club. You're probably wondering how I got in this situation. And for the record, I've only seen the theatrical cut. I know there's a
assembly cut.
Assembly cut is what it's called. I'll check that out before we record.
Another thing there, he did go back to Madonna right after. He did the Bad Girl video.
Which is such an amazing video. God, I love that
video. It is an amazing video. But the thing about it is, when Madonna is less of an antagonist than an alien, then you know you had some issues on the set.
Go from an alien to Madonna and Christopher Walken. Yes.
Yeah, I have my feelings on this as well. There are definitely things that, from my first viewing, that I'm going to rehash next week because there's things about it I still haven't said, even though I did a set of shows about this way back when. I have some major feelings on this movie, and Matt is right. There are so many things about David Fincher that is in this movie despite his wanting to disown it, and we will get into all of those next week, but it is something I've been looking forward to doing with Matt and mostly Adam forever now. So, boys, we're leading right up to a release of Alien Romulus. We're getting closer and closer, but I'm excited to go through this franchise with you boys, and until next week when we get to Alien 3, game over, man. Game over.
We better get back, because it'll be dark soon, and they mostly come at night. Mostly.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Now what the fuck are we supposed to do?
Come back every Friday, as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Look, I'm telling you, there's something moving and it ain't us.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Good killer. I'm willing to take that chance. Just cut it off and then.
You take responsibility?
Yes, I'll take responsibility. Get him out of here.
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
How far would you go to get what you came all this way for? Your answers.
Check out the Percolated Media Archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including Star Wars, the Mad Max movies, Avatar, movies featuring the team-up of Leonardo DiCaprio and Martin Scorsese, the film adaptations of author Stephen King, films of the DC Universe featuring Superman and Batman, Jurassic Park, and so many more.
Stop your grinning and drop your linen.
The Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
Oh, great. Wonderful. Shit.
The Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast is edited by Garrett.
How are you, you stupid cat?
The Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
You started this. Show me everything. I can handle myself.
Yeah, I noticed.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
They ain't paying us enough for this, man.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
Thank you. That will be all.
God damn it! That's not all! Because if one of those things gets down here, then that will be all. Then all this bullshit that you think is so important, you can just kiss all that goodbye!
The Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
Commercial starship Nostromo. Third officer reporting. The other members of the crew. Kane, Lambert, Parker, Brett, Ash, and Captain Dallas are dead. Cargo and ship destroyed. I should reach the frontier in about 6 weeks. With a little luck, the network will pick me up. This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo. Signing off.
That's it, man. Game over, man. Game over.
This was one of those rotations, and it was kind of just, it was an icon. It was just It was a formulated my childhood.
We'll talk about the rest of the cast as we get into it. What do you guys say we kind of dive right in, unless anybody has anything else to add before I get going? I'll take that as a no. Unless you guys were eaten by aliens. I'm going to go ahead and just move on. So we open up.
Like, I'm surprised this film is not sued up the ass and is not owned by the author of Starship Troopers for the way that Cameron rips off that book.
Who did that book? That wasn't Ellison, was it?
No, it's...
No.
Although it's funny, he couldn't sue Verhoeven because that movie is so different from the...
I know.
Movie that... it's Heinlein.
Oh, Heinlein. Okay. I was going to say, because Ellison was already suing Cameron for Terminator.
Oh yeah. Well, Terminator... Yeah. Like, I mean, look, James Cameron is very familiar with the legal system.
Definitely.
Between movies and his personal life.
Yeah. Oh, God.
So this is the movie I would use...
So we're getting a rundown of the mission with Ripley, who does the C-3PO thing of telling the backstory of how they got here on this bug hunt.
Yeah, except I don't want to leave her behind like I did with C-3PO. Or sell her for scrap.
We got enough C-3PO bashing out of the way last month.
I will never have enough. It's like I'm like that bloodthirsty guy where it's like, no amount will satiate me.
But wait, there's more.
It inspires one of my favorite lines of the movie, as Hudson just says, well, then why don't you just put her in charge?
Well, if this was a modern movie, she would be accused of being a Mary Sue, and the studio would indeed make Newt lead this group, because she knows what she's doing.
He gives one of my favorite quotes, where when she finally decides that, okay, I'll go ahead and do it, Cameron goes, another liberal bites the dust.
But also, like, yeah, I remember, like, 86, we were not yet at the height of the NRA. Gun politics and controversy, that stuff wouldn't really ramp up until the mid to late 90s, and unfortunately with things like Columbine, where it would really become the talk of politics. I mean, look, it affected Spielberg so much that he removed the guns in E.T.
We don't talk about that.
Well, I have to, because I will take every chance I can to put Spielberg in to highlight how brilliant South Park is when they pointed that out. Bishop has one of the great lines where he's like, what the hell's the line? It's right before he goes into the duct, because the ship is going to, like, self-destruct. God, what the fuck is that line? Oh, where he says, believe me, I prefer not
to. Just remarkable. He's still talking shit as he's going under.
I love it. He's just talking shit the whole way down.
Yeah.
The equivalent of choke on this from, oh, God, what's the name of that fucking movie? It'll come to me.
Burke. Newt then falls, and Hen did say this was her favorite part of the shoot, was going down the slide over and over. Go ahead.
Nope, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and to those who say this isn't a horror film, look at the way Cameron composes this shot of the alien appearing in the water behind her. Freaky as fuck.
Okay, I should have went
ahead,
first.
Okay.
I was going to say, for all the things that get said about James Cameron, and he's got a reputation as an asshole for a damn good reason. I'm sorry, he's earned his reputation as an asshole of a person and as a husband. But when she said that she loved going down the slide and she wanted to do more, that they basically spent hours just going, you know what, let's give her what she needs. And reports are they spent like 2 or 3 hours just going down the slide. That means something, and it shows that it was important to take care of the one child you have on set and remind her that she's still a child. And I think that story is pretty damn sweet.
James Cameron has the temper of a child.
To this day.
Weaver has said that he's been much more mellow. Probably with the billions he's made.
He can't afford to lose half his shit a fifth time.
Yeah. Were you as many divorces as you have movies? Like...
Yeah, we're dropping down. What did Hudson's line earlier? God damn it.
Elevator straight to hell?
And we're running in that elevator straight to hell. We are...
Boys, we are leading right up to a release of... what's the name of the stupid
Romulus
new one? Thank you. We're leading right up to a release of Alien Romulus. And until next week, when we get to Alien 3, game over, man. Game over. How could I not do that one? Rest in peace, Bill Paxton.